Should we do this?
We shall.
Take it away, Simon.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercier. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to music, movies, television, theatre, in fact, anything that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately.
And this week, we've been entertained by some serious heavy hitters in the music business who've been on our shores in the last week or so. We're going to be talking about Queen with Adam Lambert, and also not with those two, but completely on his own these days, totally on his own, Robbie Williams.
Indeed. What may well be one of the year's cinematic heavy hitters has just arrived. We'll get our claws... Sorry, I couldn't help that. We'll get our claws into Black Panther.
No, you're forgiven, because it's a meaty one. It's really going to occupy a lot of our attention. Now, moving from heavy hitters to the most lightweight of fluff, I shall be trying to compose myself so I can tell you a little bit about 50 Shades Freed.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that. I've also checked out a local Pacific comedy called Hibiscus and Ruthless, which did a lot right, maybe one or two things not so well.
Fair enough. And we're also going to be asking the question that everyone needs to know. Will Lady Bird be flying high at the Oscars? And the answer to that question is quite possibly.
Right. Oh, I'm hanging on tenterhooks now. Absolutely. But let's start with one of the big rock bands of this or any other age. Now, Steve, of course, we're recording this podcast on a Sunday, and I'm wondering perhaps whether your ears are still ringing and your voice is still a little bit hoarse from singing along to We Are the Champions or, I don't know, I Want to Break Free, goodness knows how many other hits from Queen, delivered by them, of course, with Adam Lambert, as you said, at Auckland's Spark Arena just last night. So were you suitably rocked?
They did rock me.
Oh, goodness.
They did. Wow. They are indeed the champions, it has to be said. This was... let's backtrack a little bit, right? Freddie Mercury died in 1992.
Isn't that long ago? Gosh.
It is indeed. I'll never forget that I was living in Japan at the time, and I was listening to American Armed Forces radio. And to pay tribute to him, they played Another One Bites the Dust.
Right.
Which was quite appropriate, really.
Yes.
And you just think, you know, what a loss. I mean, what a singular talent he was. Mm. And so Queen got in briefly Paul Rodgers from Free.
Right.
And he's a rock star. He's a big, brawny rock star with a big, brawny rock voice. And Queen were never a rock band. Queen were theatrical, they were camp, they were glam, they were a million and one things, but they were never as one-dimensionally rock as Paul Rodgers needed them to be for him to suit. So even though they actually released an album, it never went anywhere. And finally, about 5 years ago, after Brian May had seen Adam Lambert on, I couldn't even tell you which...
American Idol. He came second 1 year.
Was it American Idol, was it?
Yes, it was.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you've done the research for me. That's
all right.
Very good of you. And so Brian May saw him and said, him. He's who we need.
Yeah.
And so they roped him in. And let's face it, nobody's ever going to be Freddie Mercury. As I said, singular talent. And so Lambert was smart enough last night, about half a dozen songs in, to address the Freddie-sized elephant in the room. Square on, he said, I'm not Freddie Mercury. I'm never going to try to be. There's no point trying. I never could be. Mm. And so instead, what he did was he sang the songs in his own, very theatrical, very camp, very glam style. And dear Lord, it worked well.
Yeah.
He has range. He has theatricality. He has everything that the songs need. He clearly enjoys them. Brian May and Roger Taylor trust him with their music.
Right.
And that's all the recommendation that we really need. And it was a bloody good show.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I remember, it's going back quite a few years now, when he was in American Idol and he was in the final two, Steve. He had, by a country mile, the better voice of... But the other, he was clearly gay.
Yeah.
Or camp. Whereas the other bloke was more middle of the road and sort of conservative. And Americans voted for the safe option, and he came second. Okay, Lambert came second, but he was... as I say, streets ahead in terms of just pure talent, and he's gone on to do all right. And I can't remember the name of the other bloke.
Exactly. So, there is a delightful irony in that one, isn't there?
Yes.
And he knows exactly who he is or what he is, and he doesn't care. Yeah. He's completely confident because he knows how good he is. And how good he is, he's very, very good.
Yeah.
You remember a couple of years ago, I think I've told you about this one, I did a review for another music outlet of one of his solo shows, and he was rubbish.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I do remember you saying that, yes.
Except when he was singing other people's songs, and in particular, he sang Under Pressure. No, I beg your pardon, not Under Pressure, another one, Bites the Dust.
Right.
That was one of the songs that he used, apparently, in the TV show. And he kind of made it his own, and he did it really well. So when he's got songs like Queen's songs behind him, he's very, very good. Queen needed a singer. He needed a band. The two gel brilliantly.
And did the rest of the audience share your enthusiasm, do you feel?
If you think I'm gushing, I'm probably one of the less impressed members of the audience. Seriously, it went down a scream. They knew exactly what they were doing. Brian May, poodle haircut notwithstanding, remains a phenomenal guitarist.
Right.
He's incredible. Roger Taylor, very, very good drummer. Probably shouldn't bother singing any longer. It didn't quite work when he tried to do a kind of magic. Leave it to Adam. He knows what he's doing. Mm. But yeah, absolutely. This show went over an absolute storm. It was brilliant.
Fantastic. Okay, a big recommendation. By the way, I reckon it's a pretty good bet that I saw one member of Queen before you did this last week.
Yes, I've seen photographs of this.
Oh, have you? Yes. So I was at Spark Arena on Wednesday to see Robbie Williams, and Tammy Nielsen was the opening act there, Steve. And where we were sitting was right on the side, right at the front. So we were peering down into what was going on backstage. And as she finished, walked down the steps, waited for a moment or two for the rest of her bandmates to follow, out pops up, as you just referred to him a moment ago, the poodle, the frizzy white hair of one Brian May, or a man who looked incredibly like Brian May, to greet Tammy and give her a hug and say, well done, and they toddled off together.
I will not believe that there are two people with that singular haircut in Auckland right now.
Well, this is only two or three days before their own show, so...
They could not have been a second haircut quite like that. It is extraordinary. But, I mean, I could gush all night about last night's show. It's the best concert I've seen, probably since Paul McCartney last year. It was superb. If you want a highlight, they obviously played We Will Rock You.
Yes.
Because of the riots that would have ensued had they not.
Yes.
And it went well, obviously. You've got the bang, bang, clap going on. And then at the end, May marched down this huge long catwalk they had that went right down to the middle of the floor at the arena. And he cranked out, I'm sure you're familiar with it, that wonderful blistering solo that he plays at the end of We Will Rock You. And it was faithful to the recorded version. And it was every bit as brilliant as you would hope it would be. There's a video on our YouTube channel of the whole song, and it's quite superb. It's worth it.
Okay, fantastic. Actually, that catwalk you're referring to was also at the Robbie Williams concert.
Tell me about Robbie Williams. Did he entertain you?
He did. He did.
I hear a pause.
Well, there's an interesting thing. The show was a great show. And you and I were both at the media conference with Robbie just a day or so before. And I thought, apart from local media trying to pull a few stunts there, Steve, I thought you know, Robbie handled it pretty well. And I thought, he seems like a pretty decent bloke. I quite like this guy. I'm looking forward to
You could have a beer with
concert.
Him, couldn't you?
Yeah, you could have a beer with him. Absolutely. That's what it felt like. I felt he seemed like a real genuine guy who knew what he was about.
Yes.
I hadn't seen him live before. I knew some of the big hits. But look, I think it was he's a very professional performer. He owned the audience out backwards, sideways, any way you'd care to describe. He had a good band, fantastic band. He had three superb backing singers. He had six young, scantily clad female dancers prancing up and down the catwalk with him. He was there in his black singlet showing all his tats and a sort of a modern – I thought it was – well, it looked like a skirt, but Sharon tells me it was really like a modern-day kilt and showed his ass to everyone right at the top, and the way he went. And he had everyone in the palm of his hand. So all the big hits – lots of very cheeky banter, excuse the pun, and quite good banter in the sense that it wasn't all just off rote. He was responding to what he was seeing in front of him. So really a polished performer. But what I want to get your thoughts on, I've been umming and ahhing, and I reflected at this in my written review on the website, cravepodcast.com, by the way.
Nice plug, Simon. Thank you.
Yes. I've just had a little bit of trouble reconciling this guy in his mid-40s singing these well-crafted pop songs, which are not challenging musically. You know, he was from, as you say, he was from Take That. He was a pop singer with that whole sort of loutish, laddish, tats, swearing, cussing, talking about women's tits in the audience type persona that he clearly wants to foster.
Yep.
And I don't know if that kind of quite worked. I'm very much alone in this because everyone else just gobbled it up and thought it was fantastic. But I note that he hasn't gone down well in the United States at all, which he's talked about. Is this just a British thing, this kind of laddish thing that doesn't necessarily translate in other parts of the world, Steve? I'd like to know what you have to say about this coming from that part of the world yourself.
Well, he's from Stoke-on-Trent. I'm from Manchester. We're very nearly neighbours. We bonded at the press conference over accents, yes.
You did. That's right.
And so I feel like Robbie and I, you know, we're tight now. You know, I feel like we've bonded. But I know what you mean. It's a very... very, very English, not even British, but English kind of thing, this laddish, this blokish thing.
Yeah.
And it is something that's kind of separate from the music, really.
Yeah, it is.
And you're right, much of his music is very pleasant and it's very agreeable. And so songs he played Angels, obviously, because much as Queen wouldn't have escaped the auditorium without doing Bohemian Rhapsody, he would never have made it out of the place alive if he hadn't done Angels. Mm. But it's a very simple song. It's a very pleasant song. There's nothing wrong with it. And I saw him a couple of years ago, and I was delighted when he closed the set with it then. But no, there's not a huge amount of substance there, is there?
Yeah, it's mainstream pop is what it is. And the other aspect of it, which I'd like to know what you think. It did strike me. He still plays the sex object card.
Yes.
Heavily.
Yes.
And one woman, and people respond to it. One young woman had a placard up saying, if you don't, please sing Angels. And she referred to her breasts and then bared her breasts to him to sort of cajole him to playing Angels as if he wasn't going to. And then later he chose a young woman to come up on stage to sit next to him while he sang Something Stupid. And he actually said to the audience, oh, I'm going to, would you come up, please? I'm choosing you because I like your face, and excuse my English, I like your tits. Now,
moved on from this?
Well, that's, you know, I'm just wondering a little bit. And he excused people. There was a bit of a reaction. And then he said, oh, excuse me, I'm a man of the 80s or something like that. And that sort of got a bit of a laugh, and people seemed to accept it. But then when she got up and she sat next to him, and it turned out she was only 19. And here's a man in his mid-40s with his arm around a teenager. I just started to feel a little bit like, I'm not sure, Robbie. And then at the end, you could see that she was talking to him.
Yeah.
At the end, to his credit, he disclosed to everyone that her mother had just died.
Yeah.
We don't know how long ago, but her mother had died. And so he dedicated the song to her mother. So good on him for that. And I think he kind of rescued himself to a certain extent in doing that. But I just felt, you know, occasionally he was sort of grazing against the bottoms of the young teenage dancers and everything. It just, I don't know how long you would want to keep doing that for. It's all part of the sex thing. I know it's part of the show and everyone seemed to love it.
It's all part of his laddish shtick, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. didn't sit so well with me. It began to grate with me a little bit. But overall, you know, everyone there just had the time of their lives. He did all the songs they wanted him to sing. One thing I say from Steve, a couple of times the band went off and he was just him by himself and his mic and the audience talking, singing a couple of big hits a cappella and getting everyone else to join in the chorus song. I mean, he did that very well. He's absolutely so at ease in front of an audience. It's, you know, he's got a wonderful talent for just not being flustered, not being nervous, just being, wow, I'm just here, take it easy, guys. You know, that sort of attitude.
No, he has an undeniable stage charisma.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no doubt about that. He's got a very good voice, and he can sing. But like you say, most of his songs are undemanding. I mean, I'll be the first to admit, you and I had struggled to sing them. I'll go with that one. But then they're not... We'll put it this way. There was no way in the world he was changing places with Adam Lambert.
Right.
He's not that good.
No, he's not that good. No, he's not. Anyway, I'm glad I saw him.
Well, listen, tell me about the first half of the show, though, because I know, you know, we can kick Robbie around all night, and we'll probably lose a lot of friends if we do so. I do know that you and Brian May both have a soft spot. I mean, obviously, when it comes to hair, you and Brian May could hardly be further apart.
I'll rub it in then, why don't you? Yes.
What the cream?
but
you two clearly have a soft spot for Tammy Nielsen. So tell us more about Tammy.
Well, I'll just quickly tell you about Tammy. It's a couple of things worth saying about her. You may recall from the last time we spoke about her, she's got one hell of a voice. I mean, this woman can really belt it out.
Yes.
All sorts of styles of music. She's got a powerhouse voice. She used it very well. She's got a new album coming out in a couple of months, she said, and she sang, I think, at least two new songs from that, which songs she'd written. She was dressed in a gold, tight-fitting, sparkly dress with a black wig, looking kind of like a diva-type image. A very good band. And so I was impressed as I ever had been with her voice. There's one interesting thing about her, which on this night, anyway, which struck me, struck Sharon, my partner Sharon, too. She, you know, there's a bit of banter in between songs, Steve. And she went to... a lot of trouble to talk about the fact she was originally Canadian, but you know she's been here for a while and she's given birth to a couple of kids and she had to. She, what was the phrase? I've pushed out a couple of Kiwis or something like that. It was just a bit crude, and I just thought, has someone told you that that's the way to somehow get on the right side of New Zealanders, or is that genuinely who you are?
Subtle combination of both, I should imagine.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't recall her being quite as... It felt a bit forced. It felt like someone had told her that's the way you need to behave. And I don't know.
Having heard what you said about Robbie Williams, could it be that that's how she thinks she relates to his audiences?
Well, maybe. Look, that could be... Yeah, that's a good thought. It might well be. The other thing about her is she's got such a range of different styles, Steve, just quickly, because she can do the country, but there's a lot sort of rockabilly... soul, bluesy. Yeah. She could sing anything and would sound great.
Right.
But maybe that's making her a little bit of a chameleon, and you're not quite sure where to put her in your mind as to what sort of performer you're being confronted with. But I think I'd be looking forward to hearing that new album when it comes out. If you ever get a chance to see her, do, because her voice is really, really good. And the band is excellent. So I just had a couple of question marks about where she was coming from in her patter.
Right.
But, you know, maybe I'm being a bit too finickety. I don't know. I could be.
That's our job, Simon. We're music critics.
Right.
That's what we do.
That is. Yes.
Right. Now that you've drawn breath, should we move on to matters cinematic?
Yes, please.
And now... You, I know more than I, Simon. You've been disposed, shall we say, to the never ending. It feels like sometimes, doesn't it? stream of Marvel superhero movies that just seem to be like there's like one every 15 minutes sometimes.
That's right.
It feels like I can't remember a world without them.
No,
but we've seen something. Let's face it, that's a little bit new.
Yes, so you're absolutely right. I mean, I have to say, I read a lot of this stuff as a kid in comic books. So, yes, Steve, you're right. I'm not the most dispassionate reviewer of these films.
Hey, look, I gushed about Queen. You can have a gush about Black Panther if you want, mate.
But yeah, but Black Panther is what we're talking about. It's been much heralded, and a lot's expected of it, Steve, both at the box office. I think there are very high hopes commercially, and I think, you know, they're hoping that it's going to be a well-reviewed film. Given that I'm probably going to, everyone knows what I'm going to say, I'll just hand it over to you initially. I mean, I thought it, just other than for me to say, I thought it was a very well put together film that was entertaining in its own right, but also because of what's going on in the world at the moment, it seemed to resonate very strongly with affairs and news of the day, to me anyway. But over to you.
Well, it's hard to know how to attack a film like this. To be fair, what's your way into it from a critical review point?
Yeah, I mean, okay, yeah, I know what you're saying. Well, I mean, the nuts and bolts of it are: this is another Marvel film. This is another character who was invented by the writer Stan Lee way back in 1906, called Black Panther. Black Panther is the alter ego of King T'Challa, who is the ruler of an African nation called Wakanda. And Wakanda is, interestingly, situated right in the heart of Africa, but it is a rich, educated, smart, wealthy nation, keeps to itself because it owns almost a monopoly on the world supply of this precious metal called vibranium. So We met Black Panther, didn't we, Steve, in one of the earlier movies called Captain America Civil War. He was introduced there. This is
very,
a full movie.
Very teasingly, very tantalizing.
Yes, yes. So this is the full movie where he now, T'Challa, his father died in the previous one. He now assumes the kingship, and he's confronted with an effort to steal and make other use of the vibranium that the Wakandans hold close to their hearts. And so the film, we don't want to spoil the plot too much, but you have a white thief called Ulysses Claw, played with great gusto by Andy Serkis, who wants to try and sell this vibranium in weaponized form. He's aided by a character called Eric Killmonger, played by Michael B. Jordan. Killmonger has been around in the comic books for a long time. We're not quite sure where he's coming from initially in the film. And all the while, T'Challa, who's played by Chadwick Boseman,
Boseman
is trying to decide, well, okay, first of all, we've got to track down the vibranium and bring Ulysses Claw to task. But more than that, is it time for us to change our views about keeping to ourselves? Is it time for us to engage with the world and share our wealth and our knowledge? Or do we just hunker down and ignore the rest of the world? And so that's a big theme that's playing in the backdrop around a film which, I don't know what you thought, visually was wonderful. Wonderful. A lot of thought and effort, and the design of the costumes and the settings was great. So that's my quick summary. It fits into the Marvel Universe. It's a standalone sort of film to a great deal. Oh, can I use my pun, please?
Well, it's not really your pun, is it, Simon?
I know, I stole it.
I know, from me. And to be fair, I stole it myself in a way, but go on.
Oh, which one are you talking about then? The Tolkien Whites?
Oh, you've ruined it now. You bugger. Go on, take your pun.
I heard it from someone else the other day, and I forgot that you'd said it as well. The Tolkien Whites are the aforementioned Andy Serkis and Martin Freeman. Both, of course, have been in Hobbit and Lord of the Rings films, and both did a really good job, actually, in these films.
But basically, anyway, it's not their film. It's very much a film that revolves around, first of all, King T'Challa, fair enough.
Yes,
and also very, very much around the female leads. This is one of the most female-heavy Marvel films so far. I mean, you say it's part of the Marvel Universe, but barely. It has the most tangential connection with the universe as a whole. It really is its own discrete thing. It stands and it falls completely on its own merits. And I'd say it stands. It's got an amazing cast. Chadwick Boseman possibly is the weak link. The film revolves around him, but he doesn't do a whole lot. But Michael B. Jordan as Eric Stevens, he starts out as, but he's basically revealed as Killmonger, is superb. But I think the film is completely and utterly stolen by Lupita Nyong'o and Letitia Wright.
They own
this film.
I thought, yes, so just to Letitia Wright plays the younger sister of T'Challa called Shuri, and yes. I think she's a scene stealer if ever there was one, wasn't she?
She's superb, yeah.
She's the brains behind his sort of brawn, if you like. I thought she almost was like Q in the Bond films when she equips him for the mission.
Oh, there's a lot of Bond parallels,
isn't there? Yeah. So she's got some great funny lines. She's smart. She's sassy. Fantastic. And then Nyong'o is T'Challa's love interest, but she's not just a romantic partner.
No.
She's a political activist. You know, she's got a strong a role to play in the actual story. So yeah you're right. And on top of that, you've got Danai Gurira as General Okoye.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, she's one kick-ass general. The same actress who was in has been in The Walking Dead, dispatching zombies for a number of years, and she knows how to wield a spear. So yeah, you're right. A lot of strong female characters, whether that's by accident or design, that resonates with the whole Me Too thing, Steve. I think these characters have been in the comics for a long time,
yeah,
so they're not new.
The film's been in the pipeline since way before Me Too. It's just that they're such good characters, and they've got a fantastic cast to back them up. They are superb. Like I say, Chadwick Boseman, I think, is possibly the weakest link in it. He's given that much to do.
No, and the other thing with him is he's kind of just a noble, well-intentioned good guy, isn't he?
He is, but there's so much going on around him.
Yes, and I think his character isn't given as many quirks as perhaps some of the others who are there. But you know, I think at one point of the film he's absent for a little while.
Yes,
and I didn't mind that much really. So, but you know, it's not a bad performance or anything. It's just I think he's. There's a lot of great acting, great scripting going on around him. And, you know, that's fine. It's just there's a lot to absorb. What about the whole look of it, the way in which...
Oh, it's gorgeous. It is amazing to look at. There's no escaping the fact that you and I, middle-aged white guys, have had everything about us forever, basically, right?
Mm.
And so you've got... one scene which is effectively the coronation of T'Challa.
Yeah.
Which kind of goes a bit pear-shaped for him, to be fair. But it's his anointing as the new king of Wakanda.
Yes.
And it is so far removed from anything that you would expect in the Western paradigm as the coronation of a new king.
Yeah.
And yet, it is done with so much dignity and beauty and elegance and the colours and the rhythms and everything about it. Is utterly engaging. It's unapologetic, and it owns itself, and it knows exactly what it's about, and it's brilliant.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's unashamedly saying we are proud of our culture, and we are incorporating the tradition of our culture with the modernity that we've been blessed with by this vibranium.
Yes.
And the opportunity it brings to create a modern, wealthy, smart society. So they are not leaving behind... where they've come from, and some of the costumes are beautifully, colorfully designed.
Yes,
the architecture of the modern city of Wakanda. There's even one of the aircraft that has looks like a dragonfly or something.
Oh, yes.
I thought that was brilliantly conceived. So visually, there's just a lot to absorb. Yeah. I'd almost go and see it another time just to try and sit back and.
Look at it.
That's right.
I mean, we mentioned the James Bond thing earlier.
Yes.
There's definite parallels. You can even make the case that Martin Freeman ties in with the Felix Leiter characters in the Bond films. There's definite parallels. But there's one scene where they're in a casino in South Korea. And I wouldn't be surprised if they actually use the same sets or the same locations as the Macanese Casino in Skyfall.
Skyfall, yes. I thought the same thing.
Very, very, very similar.
Yeah.
And why not? It's a gorgeous setting. And they used it to good effect. Yeah, this was just a genuinely good film. Now, we have to talk about the politics of the film, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I was last 2 or 3 weeks, Steve, if you'd cast your eye across the New York Times or the Washington Post or any other, particularly American media, you would have seen a lot written about this.
Yes.
And a lot is coming at it from the point of view of the people making it, wanting to make a positive statement about black identity and pride, wanting it to be very clearly understood that there's a film, you know, there's a black director and a black writer, as well as a predominantly black cast coming out at a time when, you know, Americans have heard their president dismiss much of Africa as a shithole.
Yes.
And so And also that this great powerful country could be in Africa. It's not it's not America, it's in Africa. I mean, that's a very strong statement just in itself, just deciding whether they'll keep to themselves or should they engage with the rest of the world, which is what my American studies tells me. Didn't American presidents in the First and Second World War have to grapple with just that very thing about
– Indeed.
Do we join the fight against fascism or whatever? So,
and then Killmonger's conflict with the rest is in what way should they engage?
Yes, and that's really interesting and well thought out. And I thought the story was pretty cleverly layered.
Yes.
It was not dull. It had a bit of meat to it. I don't think you necessarily have to approach it from the point of view of thinking about all the politics around it, but I found it almost impossible not to. There are a couple of lines, I don't want to spoil them, but there's a couple of lines. There's one near the end which had a very Trumpist sort of reference to me about it. But it's you can enjoy it on both levels. It stands fairly and squarely on the merits of its own story and its entertainment value without having to think about the politics in which it's arisen. But I'd give it a very strong recommendation.
And I'd say that's the most important thing of all. You can have all the right on politics you want. And yeah, why shouldn't we have films with strong black leads, with African themes, with brilliant, powerful women leading the story? Yes. Do that by all means. But in the end, what matters is, does the film stand or fall on its own merits? And the answer has to be...
Yes.
Certainly does, doesn't it?
It does. It's a sort of superhero film you'd take someone to who's not a fan of superhero movies.
Yeah, I'd go along with that. Yeah, very definitely.
Because there's enough going on, the politics of it, the story, the look of it, there's costumes, the scenery. You could there's a lot to enjoy there without having to worry necessarily whether the Black Panther can do this or that with his suit on. You know, that's not really that important.
No 20-minute fight scenes where half a city gets demolished.
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of a relief, really, isn't it?
It was. I mean, as we've established in the past, I am not a huge fan of these. You know, of the two of us, you are, I'm not.
Yeah.
But this is by far the best I've seen of those films.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Okay, good. Okay, well, that's great. Now, I just want to say, Steve, that once everyone's finished listening to you and I right now, I think they should go to our website, cravepodcast.com, and they should read your no-holds-barred and thoroughly entertaining dissection of 50 Shades Freed, which is the third, isn't it, the third film of this lot, because I think it would be fair to say you did not pull your punches.
It's rubbish. I mean, let's just leave it at that. It's absolute twaddle. It really is. I mean, look, you've got... Oh, come on, it's not that bad. You can't throw your camera on the floor in disgust.
I'm sorry about that. Look, that seemed like a very clever thing to do, wasn't it?
It seemed appropriate.
It seemed very appropriate. What? Toss my camera to the ground. Are you reading me reasonably, seeing me about right now? Not that it matters too much.
No, seeing you just fine.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I saw that film just fine as well. I mean, it was always going to be a weird experience. I went on my own on a Saturday afternoon, one bloke on his own. Hello, I'd like one ticket to see 50 Shades, please. Yes, just the one. It's me on my own. You see, I realise it's not a good look.
And brave man.
And well, I was brave on a number of levels. I've seen the first two films. And so I went solely out of a sense of completeness. It's not because I had any particular desire to see this film. It's bad. It's rubbish. It's not bad enough to be good. It never quite manages to be camp enough or rubbish enough to actually be entertaining. It's just dull.
That's the worst thing you can say, isn't it? It's dull.
That's the worst sin a film can ever possibly commit. There's notionally a story. I mean, by this stage, you know, most of our listeners will be vaguely aware of the setup, that you've got this simpering little girl, notionally a woman, but seriously, I mean, she comes across as being about 9 years old, called Anastasia, who's in this bizarre codependent relationship with a abusive man-child called Christian Grey. And at the end of the second film, they get married for reasons that make no sense whatsoever. And so the third film starts with their wedding, which looks like it's
taking place in a hotel convention center somewhere. It's you then get this ridiculous montage of them in the south of France somewhere, being rich, because that's what they do. They're rich. It's money porn.
Right.
It's wealth porn, and that's all it is. And it's as my late Aunt Mary used to say, fur coat and no knickers. There is no substance to it whatsoever. There's no class, no style at all. It's just opulence and wealth for the sake thereof.
Yeah.
And then that's the same for the rest of the film. There's this kind of a backstory about some ex-boss of hers who's trying to kidnap her or something, so you don't really care because you don't, you know, maybe if she gets killed off the film will end, so you get hopeful for a second. It's just bobbins, it really is.
You kind of wonder why they bothered or how they could justify making the second and the third. Maybe they made a bit of money, maybe there are enough people.
They must have made absurd sums of money because people are paying to see this nonsense. Why is beyond me,
you know. Yes.
Remember it was badged as mummy porn, it was going to be erotica for bored housewives or something. They managed to take two moderately attractive people who spend much of the film with their clothes off and make it as unerotic and untitillating as you can imagine. It has no sexual charge to it whatsoever. You've got two people who talk like they are reading scripts in a foreign language. There is no chemistry between them whatsoever. They wander around with their kit off. Obviously, we only see them naked from the waist up because there's clearly censorship issues there that, you know, certain lines we simply can't cross. And that line seems to be somewhere around the top of the pelvis. So even the nudity is very, very constrained. The sex scenes are as utterly robotic and tiresome as you can imagine. It is rubbish.
Yeah.
And yet there's one scene. There's one solitary scene where you think, okay, this film has an idea of how to actually be a film. It's actually got a moment where it's doing something moderately interesting. And it's one scene where James Foley, the director, who's done... let me just check. I don't really care, to be honest. But I'm he didn't do the first film. He did the second two. And you think, okay, he actually knows how to make a film.
Yeah,
and then that scene's over, and you think, okay, fair enough. He got lucky.
Well,
I can't even get angry about it.
Yeah, because it's just such a damp squib.
Yes, there you go. That'll do quite nicely.
Yeah.
Don't encourage them. The only good thing I can say about it is it's the last one. If we're lucky, it's over.
Great. Good. Let's hope. Well, I've not been tempted, and I'm still not going to be tempted, so...
I'm not selling it, am I not?
No, you're not. That's all right,
though. I didn't think so. Tell me about a good film.
Well, I'm going to tell you about a New Zealand film, a comedy, called Hibiscus and Ruthless.
That's an odd title, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the names of the two leads, and... Just as we were talking about Black Panther celebrating Black African culture, this film celebrates Pacific and is specifically Samoan culture in Auckland.
Right, that's a very specific culture.
Yeah, it's set in Auckland. It's about a Samoan family, and there's a lot that's good about it. I've got a couple of reservations, but really, the more I think about it, there's a lot to be recommended. The lead character who's called Hibiscus is played by Suivai Altangavaya, and she is a young woman whose mother, played by Lapitanga Mafaufau, his mother is very strict and stern and says, daughter, you have to keep to your studies while you're at school, while you're at university, you don't go out, you don't have boyfriends, you don't go to parties, you do your studies, you get ahead in life, you make something of yourself.
Right.
What mother says, mother goes in a Samoan house. We don't know what's happened to the father. So that's the basic premise, and the story revolves around the degree to which Hibiscus can withstand the temptation of a young woman in the big wide world, in this case around the University of Auckland, meeting a lot of other interesting, attractive-looking young men.
And we know what a hotbed of debauchery Auckland University would be.
Yes. And now the ruthless of the title is a childhood friend who's a Palangi, a European, and Ruth or Ruthless, And what's interesting about her, and it's a very good idea, Steve, was that she is basically lives with and has been adopted by the Samoan family. She almost lives there all the time. She adopts a bit of their language, their mannerisms, their quirks, the way they tilt their head and they gesticulate. So she's – it's an interesting – yeah, interesting idea. But where I think it didn't quite work was that Ruthless and another one of the suitors of Hibiscus are played to almost a slapstick sort of way, overplayed in my view, whereas – the actress Suivai, who plays Hibiscus, and some of the other characters, yes, that's comedy, but it's more – I ended up being more drawn into the interesting sort of social serious side of what was going on. It's, there's some really nice depictions of Samoan culture at weddings, in the family home, some fantastic dancing and costume. We see how they the daughter relates to her mother in a very referential way. I think a lot of thought's gone into that. It's quite a treasure in that sense. I don't, and it's nice to see that culture highlighted in this way, in a very proud way, just as we're talking about Black Panther. So that worked really nicely for me. But I just think that I don't know if that's the writer or the actor, Ruthless. He says, just quickly scrolling down, was played by Anna Marie Thomas. And the writer and director is Stallone Vaonga Iwasa. And so... somewhere in there for me, the slapsticky stuff didn't quite fit in with most of the rest of what was going on. But I think it wasn't a very challenging story, and you know, but it was nicely played. And I think the lead, Suivai, I think she's got a genuine talent. I found a joy to watch. She had just a poise and grace about her. She seemed at comfortable in her own skin. Beautiful dancer in the scenes that we saw, her combining sort of modern dance with traditional Samoan movement. It was really lovely, and some nice humor. And I was thinking about you actually, Steve, because I know you in your teaching job, I'm sure you've met many young Pacific Island kids and Samoan kids, I guess.
Oh, most definitely, yes.
Yeah, and I thought, well, I wonder what Steve would make of this, seeing some of that culture at home, and what, you know, what they're thinking and feeling as expressed here, rather than just sitting in a classroom. So, yeah, it may come to DVD one day, and you might have a look at it and tell me what you think.
That's a big question then, really, isn't it? Is what's going to be the scope for this film? I mean, it's going to play well in Auckland, obviously.
Yeah.
Now, I know that Crave has an enormous global, multinational, intercontinental reach.
Yes.
Is this going to get much play, I mean, even across New Zealand, let alone around the world?
Yeah. I think it could. It's not a challenging story in terms of it's just a romantic comedy, but romantic comedies travel pretty well. I think that Hibiscus is incredibly engaging, and it's more about the story. Although the story is called Hibiscus and Ruthless, about the two young women, one European and one Samoan, it's really about Hibiscus, really, and all these other characters revolve around her. I think it could. It'd be interesting to see how the humor translates in different markets, to say. I wouldn't dismiss it. I don't think it's captured a huge audience. But when I saw it, it had been out for maybe a week or two, and it was not many people in the cinema. But it's probably not going to set the world on fire, but it's a nice little look at a culture that's, especially if, like me, you grew up in Auckland and went to school with lots of Samoan kids and played sport with them and whatever. And so I just found it quite a heartwarming thing to see it there, really, and for it to be celebrated. So I am going to recommend it and say it's not, maybe doesn't quite hit all the spot marks it should, but I'd say it's worth a look.
I shall check it out.
Please do. Now, there's one more film that's hot off the press, I think, because we were just about to wrap up our timeless script here for today's podcast, and lo and behold, Mr. McCabe jumps in with another entry, and one that is getting quite a bit of Oscar buzz, particularly in the area of Best Actress, I understand.
Yes,
Steve.
Yes.
We're talking about a film called Lady Bird.
Absolutely. Now, first of all, let's get this Best Actress nonsense out of the way.
Yes.
Saoirse Ronan is brilliant.
Right.
That's beyond question.
Yeah.
However, just like Margot Robbie in I, Tonya,
Yeah.
She's background noise. Uh-huh. That award will be won by Frances McDormand.
Okay.
I will stake what's left of my reputation on it.
Okay. All right. You heard it first.
Having said that.
Yes.
In the highly, highly unlikely event that I'm wrong.
Yes.
Then it'll go to Saoirse Ronan.
Oh, okay.
She is very, very good as the titular Lady Bird.
Okay.
A 17-ish, 18-ish year old, not doesn't really matter. Oh, yes, it does. Actually, yeah, it does actually matter because she turns 18 during the film. A 17-year-old girl named Christine, who for reasons that are never made clear, but it's fairly obvious, prefers to go by the name of Lady Bird.
Okay.
And insists that everyone, including her parents, call her that. And she's profoundly constrained by what she considers to be her very provincial life in late 80s Sacramento in California.
Mm.
So even though it's California, as she puts it in the film, it's the Midwest of California. It's not San Francisco. It's not Los Angeles. It's very definitely the country.
Right.
And all she really wants to do is move to the East Coast, to New York, or she'll even settle at a pinch for Connecticut or New Hampshire, because that's where the culture is and that's where the writers are and that's what she has aspirations toward, even though her mother's convinced that she's no good and she'll never make it. And anyway, the family can't afford to send her there. So that's basically a setup. And the film has little in the way of sort of a driven plot. What it does have is a wonderful character study between Lady Bird, Christine, the daughter, and her mother, Marion, played to great subtlety and effect by Laurie Metcalf, who is nearly but not quite as good as Ronan in this film. And
right.
The film revolves basically around that axis. And then we're introduced to her friends, who she then kind of finds a little bit limiting because she wants to hang out with the cool kids, but she's not cool enough to hang out with the cool kids. And you can kind of see how that one's going to play out. There are moments when it threatens to descend into John Hughes territory. And then manages to carry on doing something just a little bit more interesting than that.
Yeah.
It has her attending a Catholic high school where she wants to kick against the nuns, don't we all, really? I mean, I had flashbacks myself watching this. But the nuns and the priests who run the school are surprisingly sympathetic. In fact, most of the characters in the film are drawn with enough depth and enough beauty that you do find sympathy with them. It's it's a very slow film. It doesn't really go anywhere. You can see the arcs the characters are going to go on. You can kind of predict. So in the end, in so many ways, it's not a question of the destination so much as the journey you take to get there.
Yeah.
And the acting and the character development and the very deft script are lovely.
Yeah. Okay. I was trying to, you mentioned Laurie Metcalf.
Yep.
And I saw the trailer and I thought, gosh, that face is so familiar. And I just did a quick check. And one of the times I saw her on television way back in the 90s was in Roseanne.
Yes.
And so, and I think she was very successful at television, won awards. And so she's got a lot of pedigree in behind her. Okay. Well, I think I'd like to see that. I'd like to see it because I'd like when we get closer to the Oscars, Steve, for us to be able to compare some of these performances, and I'd like to see how Saoirse gets on.
Yeah.
In fact,
that's worth mentioning in and of itself. I've heard her being interviewed. Now, in this film, she is a young American woman.
Right.
And her accent, I mean, I'm not American myself entirely. But I have spent enough time among those people. I feel like I've done like an anthropology study with them seriously sometimes. I have lived among Americans. I have lived among them. I have learned their ways. They've welcomed me into their culture. And I can spot a good American accent. And hers is flawless.
Right.
And yet, when you hear her being interviewed, she's bog Irish.
Yes. I saw a clip of her on the Graham Norton show just the other day.
It's hard to believe it's the same woman, isn't it?
Yeah, it was incredible. And in fact, she was sitting next to a couple of Americans who couldn't understand her.
She's got this really strident down-country Irish accents.
Yeah.
And you're wondering how on earth she transforms herself so utterly into a Californian girl. And she is effortless with it. She's brilliant.
she really does inhabit the character, the mannerisms, the facial expressions. She and Laurie Metcalf, between the two of them, they can drive a scene, the two of them, like nobody I've ever seen. They're brilliant together.
Great, great. Oh, well, I'll be seeing that. Good stuff.
I highly recommend it.
All right. Well, it's been a packed program, as they say. But we should, just before we go, Steve, just mention one or two items of interest coming up. I'm sure there are one or two. Again, go to our CravePodcast.com website to see all the notices that Steve has puts up there. Any highlights for you that you're looking out for, Steve?
I'm trying to think what's been announced just recently. Celine Dion has announced an additional date for her Auckland tour.
I'll Be Still My Heart.
I know. Well, I'll go one better than that. Boney M are coming back to town.
Again? Okay.
No, it's like they never left, isn't it? For rap fans, Machine Gun Kelly is coming to Auckland very shortly. But probably the biggest name that's announced is The Killers.
Okay. Yes, The Killers. Yes, I've heard of them. Yes.
Wow, you're down with the kids, aren't you, Simon?
Oh, no. Hey. What was their big hit?
Mr. Brightside.
Oh, okay.
That's clearly not speaking to you, especially. No, they
you can't be across everything.
We do our best, don't we? To be fair, we're going back to the late 90s, early 2000s there. They've kind of been off the radar a little bit for a while. But they're going to be in Auckland on Friday the 20th at Spark Arena. Then they're going out to Wellington the very next day on the 21st at the TSB Arena. And then 24th of April, it's a Tuesday, is the Horncastle Arena in Christchurch. And I have a feeling that's going to be a pretty impressive show, to be honest.
Okay. And you did mention Machine Gun Kelly. We should just mention the date. I'm just having a quick look. He'd be in Wellington on the 27th of April, Auckland the 28th, Christchurch the 29th, and Dunedin the 30th. So that's cramming quite a lot in. Okay, fantastic. As always, there's lots to keep us going, and hopefully everyone else going as well, Steve. We better wrap this up. Thank you for listening to Steve and I. We would like to hear from you, of course. Always welcome to drop us a line. You can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Crave Podcast.
Funny that. Okay, I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Outstanding.
Nice. Nicely done, sir.